killed him twice when they desecrated his grave. They don't respect anybody, not even the dead." Her voice was urgent, and when she suddenly leaned forward, I was afraid she was going to reach across the sewing machine and grasp my hand. I willed myself not to back away from her fingers, two of them bandaged as if she had pricked herself with needles. I felt that I had to say something, and so I said, "I'm sorry." I meant that I was sorry for all that had happened, not only to her but also to my mother, the accumulation of everything I could do nothing about. My apology made utterly no difference, but Mrs. Huang nodded gravely, as if understanding my intentions. In a subdued tone, she said, "I know you are." Those were her last words to me. She did not say goodbye when we left, and indeed, did not even look at us. For as my mother closed the bedroom door, Mrs. Hua was gazing down into the box, her bent head revealing a furrow of white roots running through her scalp, where the hair's natural color revealed itself along a receding tide of black dye. It was a trivial secret, but one I would remember as vividly as my feeling that while some people are haunted by the dead, others are haunted by the living. When my mother exited the freeway, she surprised me for the second time. She pulled into the parking lot of the 7-Eleven off the exit, two blocks from home, and said, "You've been such a good boy. Let's get you a treat." I didn't know what to say. My parents did not grant me so much as an allowance. When I had asked for one in the fourth grade, my father had frowned and said, "Let me think it over." The next night, he handed me an itemized list of expenses that included my birth, feeding, education, and clothing, the sum total being $24,376. "This doesn't include emotional aggravation, compound interest, or future expenses," my father said. "Now, when can you start paying me an allowance?" My mother stopped under the bright lights at the door of the 7-Eleven, pulled a crisp $5 bill out of her purse, and handed it to me. "Go buy," she said in English, motioning me inside. Whenever she spoke in English, her voice took on a higher pitch, as if, instead of coming from inside her, the language was outside, squeezing her by the throat. "Anything you want." I left her on the sidewalk and went in, the $5 bill as slick as wax paper in my hand. Remembering how my mother's lips moved whenever she used the fingers of one hand to count on the fingers of her other hand. The 7-Eleven was empty except for the two Sikh men at the registers, who gave me bored looks and returned to their conversation. Disinfectant tinted the air. I ignored the bank of arcade games and the racks of comic books, even though the covers of Superman and Iron Man caught my eye, and the electronic whirring of Pac-Man called to me. Past the cleaning products and canned soups was an aisle stocked with chips, cookies, and candy. I glanced down the aisle, saw the glint of gold foil on a chocolate bar, and froze. While the clerks chatted in a language I could not understand, I hesitated, yearning to take everything home, but unable to choose. The transplant. Many unexpected things had happened to Arthur Arellano, and the transformation of his modest garage into a warehouse, stacked with boxes upon cardboard boxes of counterfeit goods, was far from the most surprising. Written on the boxes were names like Chanel, Versace, and Givenchy, designers of luxuries far beyond the reach of Arthur and his wife, Norma. Their presence made Arthur uneasy, and so it was that in the week after Louis Vuitton delivered this unforeseen wealth to the Arellanos, Arthur found himself slipping out of his rented house at odd hours, stealing down the pebbly driveway past his Chevy Nova, and opening the garage door to ponder the goods with which he was now living so intimately. Even under the cover of night, Arthur resisted the urge to pocket a Prada wallet or a pair of Yves Saint Laurent cufflinks, even though Louis ended nearly every phone call by saying, "Help yourself!" But Arthur could not help himself, for he was troubled by a lingering sense of guilt and a fear of the law, trepidations that Louis addressed during their weekly lunch at Brodard's, where, under Louis's tutelage, Arthur had cultivated a keen taste for Vietnamese fare. According to Louis, Brodard's was the finest example of such cuisine in the Little Saigon, of Orange County. As Arthur ate the first course on their most recent visit, a succulent salad of rare beef sliced paper-thin and marinated in lemon and gingergrass, a cousin to the ceviche he loved, he wondered how the same dish would taste in Vietnam. Usually, Louis would hold forth on how the dishes at Prudard's were even tastier than those in the homeland itself, but as the waiter cleared away the plate, Louis chose another subject. Why his business did more good than harm.
"That's like beautiful people and ugly people," Louis said. "Beautiful people can't let on that they need ugly people. But without the ugly, the beautiful wouldn't look half so good. Am I right? Tell me I'm right."
Arthur eyed the next course the waiter was slipping onto their table, six roasted squab fetchingly arrayed on a bed of romaine lettuce.
"Well, I suppose you're right," said Arthur, whose grasp of capitalism was tenuous at best. "Those look delicious." "The moral of the story is this," Louis said, choosing a bird for himself. "The more fakes there are, the more that people who can't buy the real things want them. And the more people buy the fakes, the more the real things are worth. Everybody wins."
"That's the way you see things," said Arthur, lifting a squab by its slender little leg. "But don't you think you're just telling yourself what you want to hear?"
"Of course I'm telling myself what I want to hear."
Louis shook his head in mock exasperation, his eyes wide behind his sculptural Dolce & Gabbana eyeglasses.
"We all tell ourselves what we want to hear. The point, Arthur, is this. Do you want to hear what I'm telling myself?"
Arthur had indeed wanted to hear the many rhetorical questions posed by Louis over the past few months. "For example," Louis had said, "consider his eyeglasses, manufactured in the same factory that produced the real D&G frames, but after hours, with ghost workers whose shadow labor resulted in a product that cost $200 less. For those with limited income, didn't the right to own some Italian style trump any possible losses to Dolce & Gabbana? Or," Louis went on, "think about Mont Blanc." Arthur had never thought about Mont Blanc and did not know it was a pen company until Louis told him. "Did it suffer more than its workers in Wengang, China," Louis asked, "if those workers could not make their replicas of the very expensive originals?" Although Arthur had no idea what Wengang looked like, he could conjure up a blurry image of the faraway Chinese, dark-haired, tight-eyed, and nimble, somewhat like Louis himself. "I'm hearing what you're telling me," Arthur said, watching Louis eat his squab with the bird perched between thumbs and index fingers, his pinkies pointed upward and outward. "Otherwise your things wouldn't be in our garage."
"Hopefully you've been listening and not just hearing," said Louis. "Money's to be made, Arthur. Good money."
But for all of Louis's talk of profits, Arthur and Norma had refused the 10% commission Louis had offered. Loaning Louis their garage was an act of sympathy, stirred by the sight of his apartment, a one-bedroom cave doubling as a warehouse. The loan was also a way of paying back Louis's father, who had saved Arthur's life last year, however, inadvertently. As Louis nibbled on the squab, Arthur was moved once more by the memory of Men Vo, a man he had never met.
"Keep those boxes in our garage," Arthur said. "Like I told you, it's our gift."
Before Louis could respond, Arthur's cell phone buzzed. The text message was from Norma. "Pick up dry cleaning." After Louis leaned over to read the message, he poked Arthur in the shoulder and said, "You should pick up some flowers for Norma as well." Arthur meant to ask what kind of flowers he should get for his wife along with her clothing, but the arrival of the bananas flambées, Arthur's favorite dessert, distracted him from doing so. Even though he had the nagging sense throughout the afternoon of there being something he needed to do, what that was, he could not remember. All he could see in his mind's eye was the waiter lighting the thimble-sized pitcher of rum and pouring the flaming liquor over the bananas, a spectacle that never ceased to seduce him. The most unexpected thing to happen to Arthur Ariano, and the fateful event that brought him together with Louis Vo, was the failure of his liver, an organ to which Arthur had given much less thought than his nose, or his big toe, or even his right hand,
all of which he could have lived without, however uncomfortably. Thus, when his liver began dying a premature death some 18 months ago, Arthur was unprepared in every way except for having health insurance, courtesy of his younger brother and employer, Martin. The insurance covered his visit to Dr. P.K. Viswanathan, who explained that Arthur's liver was the unwitting victim of a disease Arthur understood only in its parts. Autoimmune. Hepatitis. Swiveling in his seat as he talked, the doctor said,
"Autoimmune hepatitis means that your body no longer recognizes your liver as a part of itself. When this happens, your body rejects your liver."
"My body can do that?"
"Your body is a complex organism, Mr. Arellano."
The doctor stopped swiveling and leaned forward, his elbows on the leather writing pad of his desk.
"It can do pretty much whatever it wants."
Arthur left Dr. Viswanathan's office convinced of his imminent death. Far more people needed organs than were available, and never had Arthur won anything worthwhile in his life. He was a chronic loser of bets big and small, from the thoroughbreds at Santa Anita to Pai Gow at the Comus casinos, pay-to-play tables. His undistinguished career as a gambler culminating in the loss of the pink bungalow in Huntington Beach, miles from the shore, into which he and Norma had invested 17 years of mortgage payments. After the bank repossessed the bungalow in the 29th year of their marriage, Norma left Arthur to live with one of their daughters, and Arthur moved into Martine's house in Irvine. It was there, not long after, that he learned of his diagnosis at the University Hospital, which explained how the problems he was having, the pain in his joints, the fatigue, the itches and skin rashes, the nausea and vomiting, the loss of appetite, everything that Arthur blamed on the stress of his gambling debts over the past several years were merely symptoms of a rot far deeper. But of all these signs, the one that drew Norma's attention when she came to him at Martine's after the diagnosis was the jaundice, the creeping yellowness of his skin that compelled her to exclaim, "Why haven't you been taking care of yourself, Art?" During the next hour in Martine's sun-saturated living room, Arthur humiliated himself twice, first by seizing Norma's hand and, without warning, bursting into tears, and second, by confessing to having cashed out his life insurance policy. Norma did not ask how he had spent the money, and Arthur did not have the heart to tell her about Pechanga, the Indian casino in Temecula where he had lost 7 days of his life, as well as all his money. For a long time, Norma was silent, but when she sat down at last, he knew she had resigned herself to seeing him through his illness. When she put one hand on his knee and the other to his cheek, he also understood that the autoimmune hepatitis was God's sly way of keeping them together. This was the one benefit he could find in what was otherwise a disaster, the fear of which kept him awake at nights, staring into the darkness and wondering what lay beyond it, if anything. It was the first time he had ever been afraid for his life. His one chance was the transplant. He fantasized about it the way he used to dream about winning the lottery, imagining how he would be a new man, someone kinder, more reliable, harder working, somebody to make Norma proud. Thinking about the organ that would save his life, he inevitably also thought about who the donor might be. In the months of waiting for news of a liver, he and Norma debated whether they should ask for the donor's identity if Arthur was so fortunate as to receive an organ. Sometimes, Dr. Viswanathan explained, donors or their families brushed away their right to anonymity. Eventually, however, Arthur and Norma decided in favor of letting modern medicine maintain its air of mystery and the miraculous. Thus, it was not by choice but by accident that they discovered the liver's origins a year after the operation, when Arthur was back working as an accountant for Martine at Arellano & Sons, the landscaping service founded by Arthur's father, Arturo, known by one and all as Big Art. The revelation arrived in a manila envelope from the hospital, left in the mailbox of the Spanish-style cottage that Arthur and Norma were renting from Martine at a substantial discount. Inside the envelope was a quality-of-life survey, with the donor's name printed next to Arthur's own, courtesy of a bug in a hospital computer, as they and several dozen others eventually discovered when the scandal reached the headlines. On seeing the name, he felt a tremor run through his liver. He blamed it at first for what he thought was a delusion, but when he passed the survey to Norma, she saw the name as well.
"Could it be Korean, like the Parks?" she asked.
"Referring to their dry cleaners, Mr. and Mrs. Park, migrants from Incheon via Buenos Aires who spoke better Spanish than the Arellanos did. If it's not Korean, maybe it's Japanese."
For his part, Arthur had no idea.
He had trouble distinguishing one nationality of Asian names from another. He was also afflicted with a related and very common astigmatism wherein all Asians appeared the same. On first meeting the Parks, he had not thought that they were Korean or even Japanese. Instead, he had fallen back on his default choice when confronted with a perplexing problem of identification regarding an Asian.
"There are a lot of Chinese around here," Arthur said. "I'd bet this guy is Chinese."
In fact, Minh Vu was from Vietnam, a widower and grandfather who had been killed in a hit-and-run, a story Norma discovered by sleuthing online. Faced at last with a real person and a real name, Arthur reluctantly concluded that he could not go on acting as if he did not know the origins of his transplant. As long as the donor was anonymous, Arthur was not obligated to him in any way. But now that he had a name, Arthur believed it was only right and proper to find someone, anyone, related to Minh Vu to whom he could give thanks for having saved his life. Finding that person was more complicated than Arthur expected, since there was no Minh Vu in the phone book, leaving him to call every Vu listed in Orange County, of whom there were hundreds. After going through those who spoke no English, those who hung up on him, and those who uttered something rude in a foreign language, Arthur found, at last, Louis Vu, who listened without interruption and then said, with only the slightest accent, "I'm the one you're looking for, Mr. Arellano." Louis pronounced his first name Louis, or as he put it, the French way, and for their meeting provided an address 10 minutes distant in Fountain Valley, a pleasant suburb of tract homes, condominiums, and sprawling apartment complexes Arthur had always admired for its forthright and modest motto, which embodied all that Arthur had wanted for himself, Norma and their brood. Those unassuming words were printed on a stone block situated on a meridian at the city's border, greeting Arthur, Norma, and all who entered Fountain Valley with this promise: a nice place to live. Only when he was in his own living room that evening, after a long afternoon of balancing the books at Arellano and Sons, did Arthur remember what he had forgotten, just as Norma unlocked the front door. He turned off the television broadcast of the World Series of Poker, and as he explained that he had overlooked running down to Park Avenue dry cleaning, he discerned her unhappiness by the way she uttered, without making eye contact, the noise vibrating somewhere down deep in her throat. She said, when he asked her what she was cooking for dinner, and then said it again when he asked her what was for dinner the next day while she washed the dishes. Only when he stroked her back in bed with the lights out did she finally say something else. "Let me make something very clear to you, Arthur." The pillow into which her face was turned muffled her voice. "Do not touch me and do not come close to me. But would it kill you to think about me for one moment in your life? Would it kill you to do something for me just to see what it feels like?" "It's the liver," he said, an excuse that had served him well over the past year. "I'm still getting used to it."
"No, you are not. You are completely recovered and good as new. That's the problem."
Her back was still turned to him, and her breathing was labored, the way it was when she walked up more than 2 flights of stairs.
"Art, you're 50 years old and you act 15. Now go to sleep and leave me alone."
Arthur leaned his chin on Norma's shoulder and whispered, "Didn't you say we should talk more to each other?"
"Arthur Arellano."
Norma shrugged off his chin.
"Either you sleep in the living room or I will."
Middle-aged bodies like Arthur's were not made for couches, and after a miserable night, Arthur gave in to a moment of weakness the next morning, calling his brother to ask for refuge. The phone was answered by Elvira, Catalina, Franco, his brother's Guatemalan housekeeper, who greeted him the way she'd been taught by Martin's wife, Carla.
Arellano residence, may I help you?
But when his brother said hello, Arthur discovered that he could no longer supplicate himself, for already he could foresee Martin's disapproving look, the eyes, cheeks, and lips puckering around the nose, pulled tighter together by the drawstring of Martin's facial muscles.
I just called to say good morning, said Arthur, avoiding Norma's gaze as she entered the kitchen.
Good morning.
Martin sighed.
This isn't high school anymore, Artie, he said. You're too old to make prank calls.
Even after Martin hung up, Arthur pretended to carry on a conversation, for Norma was behaving as if there was nobody in her kitchen, while she toasted two slices of wheat bread, poured herself a cup of Uban, read the headlines in the Register, and chuckled along with the K-Day disc jockeys. Arthur, hovering in the corner, sensed that he was merely a specter, already dead, acknowledged by Norma only as she brushed by him on her way out the door, saying over her shoulder, "Don't forget your pills." He found his translucent orange prescription bottles and a glass of filtered water in their usual place, arrayed on the bedroom dresser. First, he swallowed the diuretic, sipping from the glass and sighing. He hated taking most of the medications, even though the second pill, for lowering his blood pressure, was absolutely necessary, as was the third one, the immunosuppressive that ensured his aging body would get along with his even more vintage liver. Dr. Viswanathan had said that there would always be a risk of rejection, and the resulting sense of unease weighed on Arthur, the daily reminder of the alien within him that was delivered in quadruplicate form via these pills, even the fourth and final one that he somewhat enjoyed, the antidepressant. Although it was good for filing down his emotional rough edges, it was not as satisfying as the painkillers he had taken in the immediate months after the transplant, dots of magic that made his skin feel like cotton under his own fingers. The antidepressant only restored in him a feeling of normalcy. And why, Arthur wondered, should he need a pill for that? Martin's behavior that morning in the office confirmed for Arthur how correct he had been in not asking for help. The office was in Martin's guest house, a clapboard cottage separated from the main house by a swimming pool cleaned with a robotic, stingray-like device that kept the water sapphire blue. Arthur had barely turned on the computer and begun contemplating his morning game of blackjack when Martin entered, sat on the edge of Arthur's desk with its stacks of unfiled receipts and invoices, and began going into minute detail about his family's vacation at Lake Arrowhead that weekend.
Jet skis, Martin said, champagne brunch, filet mignon, pink sunsets.
This, at least, was what Arthur heard, the office itself affecting his hearing, with everything from the brass paper clips to the Art Deco sconces reminding him of what his brother possessed that he did not. Arellano and Sons, bequeathed by Big Art only to Martin, when Arthur's bad habits became obvious to their father.
So how was your weekend? Martin said. How are you and Norma doing?
We're fine.
Arthur studied the computer screen where he was being offered the chance to double down on a pair of tens.
We're doing great.
Just thought I'd ask.
When Martin rotated the platinum watch on his wrist, Arthur saw black threads of earth under his brother's fingernails. Arthur suspected Martin deliberately left the dirt there as proof of how he ventured out with the landscaping crews to trim a few hedges once every week, another sign of the saintliness that led Martin to trust, or perhaps to torment, Arthur with the accounting.
You know, Norma talks to her pedicurist, who talks to Elaine, who talks to her mother, who talks to me.
I don't even go looking for this, Artie. I just hear it because it's out there.
I appreciate your concern. Arthur doubled down and drew a king and an ace, the kind of good luck that never happened when he was playing blackjack at the casinos. But maybe the pedicurist said something different to Elaine, who said something a little different to Carla, who said something a little different to you, until you heard something a lot different than the way things are.
Martin sighed, coughed, and glanced at his watch.
"We're brothers, Artie," he said, raising himself from the desk, which creaked in relief. At the door, Martine paused, as if to say something else, and then left, the absence of his considerable heft palpable, an imaginary cutout into which Arthur's own body could fit. According to Dr. Viswanathan, the donor would have been a man of roughly the same size and weight as Arthur himself. And from there, before having learned about Men Vo and meeting Louis, Arthur had conjectured that the donor might be in other ways like him too. Middle-aged and graying, of a Mexican ancestry only vaguely remembered by word of mouth from ancient grandparents with faces like Easter Island statues, vulnerable to the seductions of $7 all-you-can-eat Chinese buffets and sugar-glazed donuts pregnant with raspberry preserves, a profile also befitting Martine. Would Martine have given Arthur a spare part of himself? A kidney, say, or bone marrow? Would Arthur have done the same for Martine? The questions bothered Arthur all day, and later that evening in Louis's apartment, he gave the most honest answer he could to his friend. "I think so," Arthur said. "I would. I think I really would." The bones and scraps and wilted garnish of their dinner lay on the coffee table in styrofoam containers, whisked to Louis's door every evening by the teenage son of a widow who cooked for 24 bachelors. She used a 4-burner stove in her own kitchen to conjure dishes that were, Louis said, minor masterpieces, aromatic catfish caramelized in a clay pot, tender chicken sautéed in lemongrass and chili, a deep-dish omelet of mushrooms and green onions, wok-fried morning glory studded with slivers of garlic, everything meant to be dipped in a pungent sauce that was the lifeblood of Vietnamese cooking, a distilled essence of fish imbued with the color of dawn and flecked by red chili pepper. Satiated, Louis sighed in appreciation and said, "It's like getting shot at. No one really knows what they'll do until bullets are flying." "Really, I would," Arthur said. "Even though I can't stand him, he's still my brother. It's easy to say when you won't ever have to do it." Indeed, Arthur never would. After he had bravely announced to Dr. Viswanathan that he too wished to donate his organs, the doctor had explained how the cyclosporin and corticosteroids Arthur ingested to keep his body from rejecting the liver had ruined his body for donation. Secretly, Arthur was pleased, feeling that his decision to donate, before he was told he could not, gave him a toehold on the moral high ground, the kind of real estate that Louis said could not be bought. Louis knew the value of real estate, for he owned 2 houses and a condo in Paris, the affordable suburb in the far eastern reaches of the Inland Empire that he liked to call the Other Paris. Even now, Louis was doing his homework, watching a television show about increasing the resale value of houses with simple and inexpensive renovation ideas that involved thrift store shopping, dumpster diving, and attic treasure hunts. "I love that stick-on floor tile they're using in the kitchen," Louis said. "From here, you can't even tell it's not really marble." "Why don't you just live in one of those houses you bought?" Arthur said. Louis's apartment was even bleaker than before. With the inventory gone, the mismatched furniture was fully exposed, as were the walls, once white, but now gray. "You should enjoy your quality of life. That's one thing I've learned this year." "But I am enjoying my quality of life." Louis stretched out on the couch, from whose depths would later emerge a double-sized bed for Arthur. "I'm thinking about how my renters pay my mortgage and how I'll profit from those houses in a few years. I'm thinking about how I'm going to corner the market in better-than-genuine goods, which is a bigger market than the one for things most people can't afford to buy." This, Arthur realized, was the difference between them. Arthur thought of what he had done, what he was doing, or what he should have done, but Louis thought only of what he would do. For example, rather than resigning himself to saying fake or knockoff, Louis preferred to say better than genuine. But, he always emphasized, his wares actually were better, in the sense of being much, much cheaper. Why own one of the originals, he liked to say, when for the same price you could own a dozen, 2 dozen, even several dozen, of the better-than-genuine version. It's not all about money, Louis, Arthur said. What about a wife? A family?
You mean love?
Louis pointed to the gold ring on Arthur's finger.
Can you say that's made you happy, Arthur?
It's not love's fault if things haven't worked out between me and Norma.
I've tried love, Louis said, as if it were a kind of soft, malodorous French cheese. It's okay,
but the problem with it is the other person involved. She has a mind of her own. Can't say the same thing about things.
Arthur watched Louis for any sign of irony, but the small frown on Louis's face indicated he was serious.
Tell me about her, Arthur said. Or was there more than one?
It's all in the past, Arthur.
Louis gestured over his shoulder dismissively.
And I never think about the past. Every morning that I wake up, I'm a new man.
Arthur had tried to get Louis to talk about himself before, never with any success, and so he changed the subject.
Thanks for letting me sleep over, Arthur said. I appreciate it.
You're my friend, Louis replied.
Arthur interpreted the statement to mean that he was Louis's only friend, for Louis never mentioned anyone else.
You're my friend too, Arthur said, putting as much feeling as he could into his words.
For a moment, the two of them maintained eye contact and smiled at each other. Then, before the situation became more emotionally complicated, Arthur excused himself to go take a shower. The first inkling Arthur had the next morning of a less than auspicious day was the office computer crashing, taking with it into oblivion the last week's worth of record keeping. Despite Arthur's tinkering, the computer was still frozen at the end of the day, and it was a frustrated Arthur who climbed into his Chevy Nova, turned the ignition, and heard nothing but a mechanical screech, leaving him to ask for a jumpstart from Reuben, the Ariano and Sons landscaper who worked on Martine's house and who had once confessed to Arthur that he was indocumentado, which Arthur knew was true for more than one of Martine's gardeners. By the time Arthur stopped off at home to pick up fresh underwear and his razor before he went to Louis's, he was wondering what more could happen. Norma was in the kitchen, microwaving a TV dinner, and when she saw him, she gestured at the notepad by the phone, saying, "Someone called for you." Arthur was relieved at having something to do besides scurrying furtively around his own home. The caller's name was Min Vo, and as Arthur dialed the number, he wondered if this person was one of the many he had called months ago. While Arthur had not recognized the accents he had heard then as being of Vietnamese origin, he could now hear that accent quite clearly when Min Vo answered the phone, even if his English was perfectly understandable as he said, "I think you know my father."
"I do?"
"His name is Meng Vu."
"Oh, so you must be Louis's brother," Arthur said. "You didn't tell me he had a brother named Min."
During the brief pause on the phone, Arthur could hear a woman cooing to a crying child. Then Meng Vu said, "Who, Louis?" The remaining conversation took 6 minutes. After Arthur hung up the phone with a shaking hand, he informed Norma that Meng Vu had 8 children, not 4. None of whom were named Louis. One of them, Min, had received the apology from the hospital after it had accidentally revealed their father's identity to the recipients of his organs. 7 strangers had inherited not just his liver, but also his skin, his corneas, his ligaments, his pancreas, his lungs, and his heart. And these 7 strangers now knew their father's name. For the past few months since the hospital's apology, the Vo clan had been arguing about whether or not to contact these 7 strangers, and only now had they agreed to do so. At first, Arthur hadn't known whether to believe Louis or Min Vo, who was outraged when Arthur said, "How do I know you are who you say you are?" But Arthur began to be convinced when, without hesitation, Min Vo had provided him with a phone number, an address, and an invitation to visit his father's house in Stanton, where, he said, Arthur would find photographs, hospital records, X-rays, and ashes. Having kept himself calm for the time required to tell Norma the story, Arthur suddenly discovered himself in need of a drink. He found the last bottle of wild turkey he had ever bought stashed beneath the kitchen sink, half full and untouched since the diagnosis.
Oh, my God! The first sip brought tears to his eyes. I can't believe this is happening.
We've got to go over there, Art, Norma said, her dinner forgotten in the microwave. Louis's got to tell us what's going on.
No, this is up to me and him.
The whiskey had burned off the fringes of his panic, and Arthur swallowed some more straight from the bottle.
Just the two of us.
You are an idiot. Norma enunciated each word, as fierce as she was during the year of waiting.
What if he gets violent?
We don't even know what he's capable of. He's been lying to us all this time. We don't know what he wants from us. We don't even know who he is.
But Arthur was not listening. The third shot of whiskey having run an electric wire from his throat to his gut and down to his toes, bringing him to his feet and out the door to the Chevy Nova despite Norma's entreaties. He was about to turn on the engine when the liver throbbed inside him, the size of a first trimester fetus, forever expectant but never to be born, calling for his acknowledgement, gratitude, and love the way it constantly had in the weeks after the operation, rendering him so breathless with its demand that he had to roll down the window and gasp for air. Overhead, the moon was shining through a tear in a curtain of clouds, a perfect round bulb of white light reminding Arthur of the first thing he had seen upon awakening from his operation, a luminous orb floating in the darkness that he dimly understood to be heaven's beacon, telling him that he had crossed over to God's side. The orb grew steadily, its edges becoming hazy until it was a whiteness that filled his vision, a screen from behind which something metallic rattled and indistinct words were murmured. Someone was saying his name, a person, and not, as he had first thought, God, for Arthur was alive, a fact he knew both from the spear of pain thrust through his side, pinning his body to the bed, and from the voice he recognized as Norma's, calling him back to where he belonged. On hearing of the conversation with Min Bo from a breathless Arthur, Louis did not open the doors to any number of alternative futures and parallel universes where he was the son of the man who had saved Arthur's life. Instead, Louis merely sighed and shrugged. He was on his knees, sorting through a new shipment of goods, the boxes shoved up against the walls of the living room and labeled Donna Karen, Calvin Klein, and Vera Wang. While Arthur sank into the couch, Louis got up and raised his hands in a gesture of surrender.
I suppose it had to come out eventually, didn't it? He said. I'm sorry, Arthur. I didn't mean to hurt you.
Arthur closed his eyes and massaged his temples. In addition to the corkscrew of pain in his guts, a headache was chiseling out a groove in his skull. It made sense now why Louis had always been evasive about visiting Min Vo's grave. While Louis had attributed this to the bad blood that had run between him and his father, the real reason was that there was no blood at all.
If you're not Louis Vo, said Arthur, then who are you?
Who says I'm not Louis Vo? You just made it up when I called you, Arthur said. Louis Vuitton is your idol, and Vo is a very common Vietnamese name.
Louis Vo is really my name, Louis said, and I'm Chinese.
Oh, Arthur gasped. I knew it! I knew you were Chinese!
But I was born in Vietnam, and I've never been to China.
Louis sat down beside Arthur on the couch.
I can barely speak Chinese. So what does that make me? Chinese or Vietnamese? Both? Neither?
I don't know, and I don't care.
Arthur groaned and rubbed his temples.
Why? Why did you do it?
Put yourself in my shoes, Arthur. Louis leaned back and crossed his legs, the feet capped in fake Fendi wingtips.
I get a phone call, asking me if I'm related to another man who shares my last name. Most people in my situation would say no. But I don't get your kind of phone call every day. And when I get it, I have to see where it takes me. So I play it along. It's how I've gotten ahead.
I want you to get your things out of my garage. The pressure in Arthur's head and the spike in his gut were excruciating.
Tonight!
Louis shook his head mournfully.
I'm afraid not, Arthur.
What do you mean you're afraid not?
Don't get me wrong, Arthur. This is business, not personal, okay?
Otherwise, I like you a lot. We've had fun, haven't we? We're friends, aren't we?
We are not friends, Arthur said,
his voice cracking, because he really had considered Louis to be a friend.
We're not friends?
Louis appeared genuinely hurt, his lower lip quivering
over something like this? Come on, Arthur!
Just get your things out of my garage tonight.
But where would I put them?
Louis's lip stopped quivering, and an expression of gloom slowly descended on his face, dragging down the corners of his lips and eyebrows.
No, I'm afraid those things will have to stay. And please, don't think of calling the cops.
It might be hard to explain why you have a garage full of fake Miu Miu and Burberry.
Then I'm going to take your things out of the garage myself, Arthur cried. I'll take them out to the desert and leave them there.
If I were you, Arthur, I'd think very carefully about touching my things.
What are you going to do about it?
You've got something on me, Louis inspected his fingertips. But I've got something on your brother, don't I?
What? Come on, Arthur!
Louis's shout startled Arthur, who had never heard Louis raise his voice or seen him lean forward, as he did now, and snapped his fingers an inch from Arthur's face.
Wake up! Who's your brother underpaying to clip his lawns and trim his hedges?
The weight of Arthur's naivete pressed him deeper into the couch as he recalled Reuben, Gustavo, Vicente, Alberto, and all those other employees of Arellano and Sons of whom his brother asked no questions, so long as they produced social security cards and driver's licenses, either real or fake enough to be mistaken for real. Those phantom identities were easy to obtain, as Louis had shown Arthur one day, fanning out 5 driver's licenses on the coffee table, each one with Louis's picture, but a different name. Arthur buried his face in his hands as he imagined a raid on Arellano and Sons, leading to arrests and deportations, with disgrace for Martine and defamation of Bigart's good name.
I think it's time for you to go home, Arthur, Louis said, leaning back into his corner of the couch. His voice was tired, and his face was pale.
Why don't you just go home? The light in the bedroom was on when Arthur pulled into the driveway, although the rest of the house was dark. He was afraid of what Norma would say, so he bought some time by opening the garage door, in case the miracle he had prayed for on the drive home had actually happened. It hadn't. The boxes were still there, flaxen in the moonlight and stacked to the ceiling and the walls, right up to the edge of the driveway. Louis had conquered every square foot of storage for his fountain pens with their plastic barrels, his sunglasses without ultraviolet protection, his watches that kept perfect time for a day, his designer jackets without linings, his pants with hems that unraveled easily, his discs of pirated movies filmed surreptitiously in theaters, his reproductions of Microsoft software so perfect as to come with the bugs infesting the genuine item, his pseudo-pills that might or might not help, might or might not harm, a garage crammed with things fashioned by people he would never know, but to whom Arthur felt bound in some way, especially when he imagined the obscure places from where they might hail. Greeting Arthur at eye level were the names of Gucci, Jimmy Choo, and Eddie Slimane, beautiful and exotic appellations written on the boxes with a blue marker. Arthur and Norma had yearned for such names upon encountering them in Bloomingdale's and window shopping at the boutiques on Rodeo Drive, but when the clerks had ignored them, they understood that they themselves were unwanted.
Arthur Arellano!
Arthur turned. Norma stood at the back door in a frayed bathrobe, her feet bare.
I can explain, Arthur said, extending his arms hopefully.
But when Norma folded her own arms over her chest and raised an eyebrow, he saw himself as she saw him then, offering nothing but empty hands.
I'd love you to want me.
The first time the professor called Mrs. Kan by the wrong name was at a wedding banquet, the kind of crowded affair they attended often, usually out of obligation. As the bride and groom approached their table, Mrs. Kan noticed the professor reading his palms, where he'd jotted down his toast and the names of the newlyweds, whom they had never met. Leaning close to be heard over the chatter of 400 guests and the din of the band, she found her husband redolent of well-worn paperbacks and threadbare carpet. It was a comforting mustiness, one that she associated with second-hand bookstores.
"Don't worry," she said. "You've done this 1,000 times."
"Have I?"
The professor rubbed his hands on his pants.
"I can't seem to recall." His fair skin was thin as paper and lined with blue veins. From the precise part of his silver hair to the gleam on his brown Oxfords, he appeared to be the same man who'd taught so many students he could no longer count them. During the 2 minutes the newlyweds visited their table, he didn't miss a beat, calling the couple by their correct names and bestowing the good wishes expected of him as the eldest among the 10 guests. But while the groom tugged at the collar of his Nehru jacket and the bride plucked at the skirt of her empire waist gown, Mrs. Kan could only think of the night of the diagnosis when the professor had frightened her by weeping for the first time in their 4 decades together. Only after the young couple left could she relax, sighing as deeply as she could in the strict confines of her velvet aoyai. "The girl's mother tells me they're honeymooning for the first week in Paris." She spooned a lobster claw onto the professor's plate. "The second week they'll be on the French Riviera."
"Is that so?"
Cracked lobster and tamarind sauce was Professor Kan's favorite, but tonight he stared with doubt at the claw pointing toward him.
"What did the French call Vont Dao?"
"Cap Saint-Jacques.
We had a very good time there, didn't we?"
"That's when you finally started talking to me."
"Who wouldn't be shy
around you?" the professor murmured. 40 years ago, when she was 19 and he was 33, they had honeymooned at a beachside hotel on the Cape. It was on their balcony, under a full, bright moon, listening to the French singing and shouting on their side of the beach, that the professor had suddenly started talking.
"Imagine," he said,
voice filled with wonder as he began speaking about how the volume of the Pacific equaled the moon's. When he was finished, he went on to talk about the strange fish of deep-sea canyons, and then the inexplicability of rogue waves. If after a while she lost track of what he said, it hardly mattered, for by then the sound of his voice had seduced her, as reassuring in its measured tones as the first time she'd heard it, eavesdropping from her family's kitchen, as he explained to her father his dissertation on the Kuroshio Current's thermodynamics. Now the professor's memories were gradually stealing away from him, and along with them, the long sentences he once favored. When the band swung into "I'd Love You to Want Me," he loosened the fat Windsor knot of his tie and said, "Remember this song?"
"What about it?"
"We listened to it all the time, before the children were born." The song hadn't been released yet during her first pregnancy, but Mrs. Kan said,
"That's right. Let's dance."
The professor leaned closer, draping one arm over the back of her chair. A fingerprint smudged one lens of his glasses.
"You always insisted we dance when you heard this song, Ian."
"Oh?" Mrs. Kan took a slow sip from her glass of water, hiding her surprise at being called someone else's name.
"When did we ever dance?"
The professor didn't answer, for the swelling chorus of the song had brought him to his feet. As he stepped toward the parquet dance floor, Mrs. Kan seized the tail of his gray pinstripe jacket.
"Stop it," she said, pulling hard.
"Sit down." Giving her a wounded look, the professor obeyed. Mrs. Kan was aware of the other guests at their table staring at them. She held herself very still, unable to account for any woman named Ian. Perhaps Ian was an old acquaintance whom the professor never saw fit to mention, or the maternal grandmother Mrs. Kan had never met, and whose name she couldn't now recall, or a grade school teacher with whom he'd once been infatuated. Mrs. Kunt had begun preparing for many things, but she wasn't prepared for unknown people emerging from the professor's mind.
"The song's almost over," the professor said.
"We'll dance when we get home, I promise." Despite his condition, or perhaps because of it, the professor insisted on driving them back. Mrs. Kunt was tense as she watched him handling the car, but he drove in his usual slow and cautious manner. He was quiet until he took a left at Golden West instead of a right, his wrong turn taking them by the community college from where he'd retired last spring. After coming to America, he'd been unable to find work in oceanography and had settled for teaching Vietnamese. For the last 20 years, he'd lectured under fluorescent lighting to bored students. When Mrs. Khan wondered if one of those students might be Ian, she felt a jab of pain that she mistook at first for heartburn. Only upon second thought did she recognize it as jealousy. The professor suddenly braked to a stop. Mrs. Khan braced herself with one hand against the dashboard and waited.